The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine.
As it happened, the morning before the date, the temperature in the City of Light skyrocketed to 103 degrees. I fled to the aisles of Monoprix, the French version of Walmart, to buy a light blue sundress that was long and flowy and cooling and would not show sweat stains while I was sitting in a romantic, unair-conditioned cafe. In the dressing room, I looked charming and summery. Back in my Airbnb, I looked dumpy. The straps of the dress were skinny, so skinny that you could not wear a bra under them. And if I didn't wear a bra, my ladies visibly sagged under the cheap, almost see-through fabric. I'd had two children. I had breastfed them both. I ran back to Monoprix. No strapless bra. Also, no charming French lingerie store in my neighborhood, as there would be in the rom-com version of this day. On a nearby boulevard, there were some chain underwear stores, including one whose interior looked as if a drunk truck driver had just rammed through the store, either to drop all the merchandise on the floor or just for the pleasure of crashing through. I bought a $10 strapless bra, understanding the futility of what I was doing. That night, the poet and I had artichokes and salmon and drank champagne. Every time I moved, I could feel my bra bunch and roll down my torso. It was at my rib cage, then my belly button, then my stomach. There was no nonchalant way to pull it up. Off I ran to the bathroom to repair the situation. Back I came to charm and delight. Down rolled the bra. Back to the bathroom, and so forth. At some point, I just gave up and stayed at the table. My bra was at my waist, my thoughts in the dumpster. What was I trying to do by dating at 50? My body was unmanageable. My life was a roiling chaos of kids and jobs and dogs and therapy appointments. I had no time for a love affair, and even if I did, I was not ready or fit to get naked. Back at my Airbnb, I tossed the bra in the trash and wondered what had happened to me over the years. I used to be someone who shopped the lingerie sales in order to procure matching bra and panty sets in a dizzying array of colors and styles. I loved the feeling of zipping through a day with a secret butterfly of lace under my clothes. My husband at the time never seemed to notice or admire these sets, and looking back, maybe that was a sign I should have examined more closely. He did not notice me very much in general, and by the end of the marriage, I was wearing stretched out 34Ds with a pair of briefs. My feelings about myself during this time were like an emotional translation of that underwear. Beige, stretched out, saggy on the rear. Not much anybody would want to look at, especially me. But the truth was, lately, my life was coming together, brightly, even joyfully. I had a new apartment, a new job, a new dog, and new friends. Why was I still letting my lingerie bring me down, or at the very least, remind me every morning and every night of the times I felt the lowest about my self-worth? As soon as I got home, I got to work. To my horror and delight, I spent 3 days shopping for underwear online. Once Instagram figured out what I was up to, it was over. An endless waterfall of lingerie rushed down my feed. I finally broke down and bought 2 bras and 3 pairs of underwear. A few weeks later, I went to a party and began to chat with a brilliant, sexy, middle-aged woman named Helen who decorates her Christmas trees with tasteful themes and serves dirty martinis on silver trays at her parties. In other words, my spiritual opposite. Over my new bra, Journelle Plunge, a color called Petal, I was wearing a silk V-neck blouse. "Your boobs look terrific," she said, because even though she is straight, she is an intuitive Southern hostess who knows just what you need to hear. "I got a new bra," I said, not without pride. And that was that. Chin up, boobs supported, lace in place, I sashayed into the crowd. Our next article by Victoria Kirby is titled Scent Therapy. When Clinique launched the fragrance Happy back in 1997, people in the beauty industry turned up their noses at a perfume designed to lift your spirits. This was the era when fragrance campaigns were all about being edgy and cool or seductively captivating, so the perky promise of spritzing on joy was initially seen as kind of hokey, and insiders doubted that the scent would catch on. Of course, Happy proved all the skeptics wrong, becoming a huge success that remains a cult favorite to this day. Its enduring legacy might have something to do with the fact that it was the first perfume created with mood mapping, a technique originally developed by taste and scent manufacturer International Flavors and Fragrances that identifies how different aromas affect our emotions. Clinique's iconic citrus floral blend doesn't just smell vibrant, it's engineered to make you feel vibrant whenever you get a whiff. What began as a novelty approach to scent creation 25 years ago is now an integral focus of the fragrance industry. Many of the newest perfumes coming out contain notes that have been shown not only to help elevate your mood, but also to soothe your soul, calm you down, or make you feel more grounded. Feelings we could all use more of in these stressful times. During the pandemic lockdown, scent became a pivotal source of calm and stimulation for many of us, from the comforting smells of cooking to transporting our minds elsewhere through scented candles and home fragrance, says Dana Schmidt, a perfumer for Gavaudan, one of the top perfume and flavor manufacturers worldwide. This heightened our appreciation for scent as a mood catalyst. Now that we're out and about again, we're still using personal fragrance to achieve this effect. If the notion of misting on good vibes sounds a bit far-fetched, science suggests otherwise. Data shows that smell triggers 75% of our daily emotions, which might explain why perfume, which we used to wear primarily to smell good for others, is increasingly becoming part of our self-care. Though one could argue that a spritz that cheers you up is also a tool of attraction, since we're more drawn to positive, upbeat people. A recent poll by market research firm the NPD Group found that 3 out of 4 fragrance consumers say scent helps lift and enhance their mood. So perfume companies are incorporating aromacology, the study of how aromas impact our behavior and feelings, into the development of new scents, using tools and resources far more advanced than what was available when Clinique Happy was created in the 90s. Gavaudan and Firmenich, another leading global producer of fragrances and flavors, have in-house neuroscience teams that study the specific emotions triggered by certain smells. They also have technologies that allow them to identify and recreate complex, highly specific scent combinations that help increase positive feelings and reduce negative moods in people. These technologies have the ability to identify and capture molecules in the air in different stress-lowering environments, such as a forest or the seaside. Perfumers can then duplicate the molecular composition of those natural atmospheres and bottle it up for your misting pleasure. Unlike aromatherapy, which addresses physical health with the smells of single-note oils and raw extracts, functional fragrances, as they're often called, are sophisticated synthesized perfumes that stimulate an emotional response, a sort of blend with benefits, if you will. To be clear, they aren't medicine, but these fragrances combine evocative, familiar notes that bring about a sense of pleasure and well-being when you wear them, explains Alexandra Monet, a perfumer for Firmenich. These emotional responses occur because of what scientists call olfactory bonding, which refers to the unique way in which our brains are wired to smell. It's why, of all 5 senses, scent has the strongest link to memory and emotion. While our other senses process information indirectly, sending it through various touch points before it's interpreted by the brain, smell messages get routed directly to the areas of the brain that regulate emotion, creativity, and memory. This is why when you smell something, you often have an immediate visceral response and can instantly recall a related feeling or memory, says Schmidt. All this high-tech analysis and neuroscience culminates in one simple goal: to design pleasing scents that make us feel a bit more joyful, relaxed, grounded, or invigorated. Our next article by Elise Lonen is titled From Wellness to Wholeness. As a child of the early 80s, I remember doing Jane Fonda's first-of-its-kind dance-based workout in our living room. It was a double-sided vinyl record with a companion book that had photographs for following along. Whether you're 15 or 50, with the help of this album and a little hard work, you can achieve a well-proportioned, healthy body, not to mention the outward glow that comes from feeling good inside, she promised. Learn to understand and respect your body. It's your temple. And remember, discipline is liberation. I also remember the late 80s invention of step aerobics, and I remember my mom making vegetarian dinners from the Moosewood cookbook because she was worried about our hereditary high cholesterol. I don't remember ever hearing the word wellness, though. Wellness, in its current form, blazed into the mainstream in the past two decades. Its core tenets in the West were basic: water, walking, whole foods. In the U.S., at least, it seemed to be an antidote to a sometimes paternalistic, often dismissive industrial health complex, steeped in medical jargon and the lack of interest in women, as well as symptoms not easily translated into a treatment plan. Western healthcare is excellent at acute interventions, less so at managing chronic illness. Of those, autoimmune diseases affect more women than men. Wellness was a bid for autonomy, a way for individuals to take control of their own well-being and stick the landing in that space between perfect health and a diagnostic code. It's a stunning and powerful idea. We are meaning-making people, though, and we needed these principles to add up to something more than rudimentary health principles. Absent our own rituals and traditions, we borrowed from cultures around the globe. Yoga, meditation, and Ayurveda from India. Acupuncture, cupping, and gua sha from China and other Asian and African countries. Reiki and forest bathing from Japan. And most recently, plant medicine and shamanic journeying from indigenous people across the world, many of whom have been displaced. Each and every one of these components, even those that are supposed to be free, hello water, have been commoditized and commercialized, packaged in the luxury veneer of the wellness industrial complex. We pay apps now to teach us how to breathe. Capitalism is complicated. My acupuncturist is worth every dollar I pay her. I rely on supplements to fill nutritional gaps. I'd much rather spend money on a massage than a shirt, and wellness has brought significant gains. After I fell off a horse and broke my neck this summer, I had to smile when my neurosurgeon prescribed only a neck brace and meditation for rehabilitation. And I'm grateful that the conversation about healthcare has shifted to include exploring root causes and environmental impacts rather than merely medicating symptoms away. But by one estimate, wellness is now a $4.4 trillion global industry, expected to reach $7 trillion by 2025, dwarfing the global pharmaceutical industry. As someone who has spent her career focusing on wellness, I'm worried that even as it promised to bring health to everyone, the wellness industry is becoming inaccessible to most. The other deep irony of the wellness industry is that in teaching us how to be, we're left with an awful lot to do. And much of this endless checklist requires buying things, tracking things, and myriad ways to otherwise fail in our wellness goals. We find ourselves on a treadmill of more, more, more with no clear destination. As Fonda barked so many decades ago, discipline is liberation. I see discipline all around me, but liberation from what? When I first bought a ring to track my biomarkers, several sleepless nights followed. I was so worried about performing in my sleep, of doing it perfectly and hitting my markers, that my anxiety spiked and I woke up throughout the night to check the app. Yes, I slept badly and gave the ring away. The other day, I met a preternaturally fit friend for lunch, only to notice a small saucer peeking out from her shirt sleeve. "Are you okay? What's going on?" I asked her, concerned. "Oh, it's just a continuous glucose monitor," she replied. "Have you been diagnosed with diabetes?" I pressed on. "No, I just want to understand how I respond to different foods in case something is unexpectedly spiking my blood sugar." "I mean, okay. Can we no longer allow for any mystery?" There's something pernicious and restrictive about planning every bite, tracking every step, and optimizing every decision. Besides holding ourselves to unreasonable standards of perfection, this feels like a disservice to the body's manifold complexity and intelligence. Our bodies are designed for homeostasis, to return us to balance no matter how we may stray. Instead, we're programming our minds to believe that we can and should have complete control over our bodies, and by extension, the world. If anything, I've learned that life is the opposite. Finding peace requires both allowing and embracing uncertainty. Peace requires relying on an inner knowing, a place we can only access through listening to ourselves, not through studying our stats. Peace also requires resilience, a sense of equanimity and calm in the face of life's many twists and turns. Many of those who are well are not satisfied with a clean bill of health, wondering what can and eventually will go wrong. Fear of disease becomes a haunting, something to stave off relentlessly. But in biohacking our way to longevity, are we not wasting our opportunity to really live? As I've watched the wellness landscape evolve, as I've seen new healing arts plucked from corners of the globe for their promise and novelty, as I've watched friends become increasingly consumed by their metrics and markers, I've often wondered what this whole enterprise is about. I believe that our quest for wellness is not actually about health at all. I think we're on a hunt for wholeness, a word and concept I very much prefer. Many of the trappings of wellness live within this larger construct. There's no need to burn it all down. But a shift is required before we burn ourselves out in an endless quest for self-optimization. The promise of wholeness is quite beautiful, precisely because its fulfillment does not live out there. Wholeness is something only we can adjudicate. There are no exterior standards to validate this achievement, no one to tell us we've arrived, or that we're done, that we look whole. There's no prescribed checklist. Wholeness is an interior sense of feeling and integrity, of feeling complete. Rachel Naomi Remen, a physician, therapist, and author of Kitchen Table Wisdom, writes, "Wholeness is never lost, it's only forgotten. Integrity rarely means that we need to add something to ourselves. It is more an undoing than a doing, a freeing ourselves from beliefs we have about who we are and ways we have been persuaded to fix ourselves to know who we genuinely are. Even after many years of seeing, thinking, and living one way, we are able to reach past all that to claim our integrity and live in a way we may never have expected to live. There is something sacred and divine about wholeness, a mystical quality and context that's largely been stripped from wellness, even though so many of its appropriated rites and rituals are holy in origin. I recently interviewed Thosh Collins and Chelsea Luger, co-founders of Well for Culture, an organization focused on revitalizing Indigenous wellness. They were careful to distinguish Indigenous wellness from the wellness industry as a whole, asserting that Indigenous wellness is as ancient as the lineage of their respective tribal nations. In their book, The Seven Circles, they offer a model of Indigenous wellness that includes food, movement, sleep, ceremony, sacred space, land, and community, arguing that spiritual energy animates each component. When he runs, Thosh explains, it's not only about fitness or improving his mile time. It's a spiritual act. It's a practice of gratitude for his body, an action that connects him with his ancestors. He believes that an individual act of healing and connection is healing for all. As they write, when viewed through the Indigenous lens, health and wellness can become so much more than an extracurricular activity or a method of fixing oneself. Collins and Luger believe wellness is a sacred task. The ultimate mark of health and wellness will be a return to balance, reciprocity, and respect for plant life, animal life, the elements, and the earth. This expanded view feels like wholeness to me, a complete context that's much larger and more meaningful than achieving ketosis. If anything, rather than ketosis, wholeness requires kenosis, a word whose etymology is an emptying in Greek. To put aside one's ego to allow something bigger to emerge, to move past self-obsession and self-optimization, to reconcile our relationship to the collective and the planet instead. It requires owning rather than denying our humanity, of choosing to see the world with love and allowance rather than as something to dominate and control. It requires compassion to ourselves and others, even when illness invariably comes our way. Once whole, we cannot be broken. Once whole, there's nothing missing, nothing to fix. 40-odd years ago, Jane Fonda reminded us all that our bodies are temples. In many ways, she was right. Our bodies are the mechanism by which we contact, experience, and metabolize the world. They house our divinity, the innate goodness baked into each of us, which connects us to all living things. Really being in our bodies and experiencing life fully requires opening ourselves up, not tamping ourselves down. Really being in our bodies requires moving past abstention and self-denial to a place of listening and allowance instead. Really being in our bodies requires shifting our attention from how we look to how we feel. This is the liberation that Fonda promised, and it brings freedom and relief. We don't get there by outsourcing our decision-making to others, whether they be healers or heart rate monitors. We get to that place of wholeness through reconnecting to the innate intelligence inside each of us. Only then can we recognize we already have everything we need, that we're already there. Our next article by Jay Shetty is titled, How to Be Alone Without Dreading It. It's no wonder we dread being alone. All our lives, we've been primed to fear it. The kid who played by themselves in the playground, they were called a loner. The one who had a birthday party, but the cool kids didn't show up, they felt unpopular. Not being able to find a plus one for the wedding makes us feel like losers. The terrifying prospect of having to sit alone during lunch is such a common theme in high school movies that Steven Glansberg, a throwaway cameo in Superbad, has made it into the Urban Dictionary as that kid who sits alone at lunch every day eating his dessert. It was drummed into us that we had to have a prom date to fill our yearbooks with signatures, to be surrounded by a squad of friends. Being alone meant being lonely. Even as adults, that fear remains. In fact, many people would rather stay in an unhappy relationship than be single. If you type the phrase, "Will I ever?" into a search engine, it predicts that the next words you will enter are "find love," because "Will I ever find love?" is the most popular question people ask about their futures. This question reveals our insecurity, our fear, our anxiety around loneliness, and these very feelings prevent us from finding love. Researchers at the University of Toronto found through a series of studies that when we're afraid of being single, we're more likely to settle for less satisfying relationships. Specifically, we're more likely to become dependent on our partners and less likely to break up with them, even when the relationship doesn't meet our needs. My client Leo had been dating Isla for nearly a year when her job took her from Philadelphia to Austin. "You should do what's best for you," she told him. "I want to be clear. I'm not sure where our relationship is going." A month after she left, he moved to Austin. "Most of my friends were in relationships," he told me. "I basically felt single without Isla, and I didn't want to be lonely, so I decided to join her." Instead of thinking about the pros and cons of moving, what were his job prospects, what was he leaving behind in Philadelphia, who did he know in Austin, did he like it there, would this step benefit his relationship, Leo was primarily focused on avoiding loneliness. A month after he moved, Isla ended the relationship. Leo ended up working remotely from a town where he knew nobody and found himself lonelier than ever. Do we want to choose or stay in a relationship based on insecurity and desperation or based on contentment and joy? Loneliness makes us rush into relationships. It keeps us in the wrong relationships and it urges us to accept less than we deserve. We must use the time when we are single or take time alone when we are in a couple to understand ourselves, our pleasures, and our values. When we learn to love ourselves, we develop compassion, empathy, and patience. Then we can use those qualities to love someone else. In this way, being alone, not lonely, but comfortable and confident in situations where we make our own choices, follow our own lead, and reflect on our own experience, is the first step in preparing ourselves to love others. When I spent 3 years as a monk, I spent more time alone than in the rest of my life put together. Though there were many monks at the ashram, much of our time was spent in silence and solitude, and we certainly didn't have romantic relationships. The emotional isolation allowed me to develop and practice skills that are harder to access among the pleasures and pressures of a relationship. For instance, the first time I went on a meditation retreat, I was appalled when I saw that I wasn't supposed to bring my MP3 player. Music was my life then, and I couldn't imagine what I would do during breaks if I couldn't listen. But on that retreat, I discovered that I loved silence. I found that I didn't need anything to entertain myself. I wasn't distracted by conversation, flirtation, or expectations. There was no music or device to fiddle with to fill my mind, and I was the most engaged and present that I'd ever been. Many of the key lessons of self-understanding are learned in solitude. Let's begin by assessing how much time you spend alone and how it makes you feel. This baseline audit is important whether you're in a relationship or not to see if you're using your time in solitude to understand yourself and ready yourself for love. Start in a loan audit. First, spend 1 week keeping track of all the time you spend alone. This means without a companion. Don't spend the time with the TV on or scrolling mindlessly through your phone. I want you to track active solo pastimes, such as reading, walking, meditating, exercising, or pursuing an interest like cooking, going to museums, collecting, building, or creating. No, you can't count the time when you're asleep. For this part of the exercise, you don't have to go out of your way to be alone. At this point, we just want to observe what your habits are. Next to the time you spent alone, write down what you did and whether doing it without a companion bothered you. You might enjoy doing dishes alone, or you might find it a painful reminder that you cooked for one. You might like to walk alone, or it might make you feel lonely. Think about when you were comfortable or uncomfortable. When do you feel comfortable alone? The point of this exercise is to help you take stock of how you spend your solo time before we develop your practice of being alone. Expand your alone practice. Now that you've assessed your baseline solitude, start doing one new activity alone every week, and I want you to deliberately choose how to spend that time. Pick an activity that you've rarely or never done by yourself before. See a movie, a performance, or a sports event. Go to a museum. Make a reservation for dinner for one. Go to a restaurant without touching your phone. Go for a hike. Celebrate your birthday. Enjoy a major holiday. Go to a party on your own. Engage in a one-time volunteer opportunity. Take a master class. Try this every week for the next month. During the activity, pay attention to how you react to a new situation. Observe any intrusive thoughts that make it hard for you to be alone. Use the questions below to reflect. How long does it take to feel comfortable? How different would it be if you were with another person? Are you better able to enjoy yourself alone? Do you wish there were another person with you? Is it hard to know what to do with yourself? Would your opinion about the activity be influenced by a companion's reaction? Depending on the activity, are you tempted to distract yourself or engage your mind with your phone, the TV, or podcast? Then, what do you love about the experience? What are the pros and cons of being by yourself? If you can't go to dinner on your own without feeling uncomfortable, what would it take to make it more comfortable? You might discover that you like to bring a book or work assignment with you because it makes you feel engaged or productive. Having a brief, friendly conversation with the waiter might be all you need to start your solo dinner on the right foot. If you see a movie on your own and miss sharing the experience with someone, find a new way of expressing yourself to yourself. Write a blog post, an online review, or a journal entry about the movie. The same is true if you take a class. Did you learn from it? What did you like? What would you have changed? Record a voice note telling yourself how you felt about the experience. It's nice to exchange opinions with someone about a movie, a class, or a lecture, but when you attend by yourself, you practice developing your ideas and opinions without the influence of someone else's taste. If you're unaccustomed to hiking alone, set a fun, low-pressure goal for yourself. It might be a physical goal, like making your best time on the hike, or it might be to find something that captured your attention and bring it home with you. You might set out with the goal of taking a photo you love that you can keep for yourself or post to social media. The purpose of the solo audit is to get more comfortable in your own skin. You're getting to know your preferences without leaning on someone else's priorities and goals. You're learning how to have a conversation with yourself. Excerpted from 8 Rules of Love, How to Find It, Keep It, and Let It Go by Jay Shetty. Our next article by Lee Haber, Wadzani Moot, Hamilton Kane, and Carol V. Bell is titled The 14 Must-Read Books of 2023. Age of Vice by Deepti Kapoor. Propulsive and heart-rending, Kapoor's newest work explores contemporary India in all its complexity. A young man's life of service and crime begins with a banal dispute over a wandering goat, which escalates into a father's brutal beating. His wife borrows money to pay for his medical care, yet he dies and the debt remains. An 8-year-old son, Ajay, is thrust into a life of exploitation and dreaming. The Great Reclamation by Rachel Heng. In Heng's rich, capacious work, Lee Ah Boon comes of age in a Singapore buffeted by cataclysmic change. He finds purpose in a supernatural gift. While fishing, he spies a chain of islands no map has ever marked, fading in and out, Brigadoon-like in the salty air. Amid World War II and the collapse of British colonialism, Ah Boon carves out his one precious life. Hang the Moon by Jeanette Walls. The author of the iconic memoir, The Glass Castle, evokes the power grabs and double crosses of the Tudor dynasty in this dazzling tale of Prohibition-era Virginia. Banished from her home after her younger half-brother's accident, Sally Kincaid leaves her charismatic father, Duke, and the small town of her youth. 9 years later, Sally forges her own path, running the family business, while navigating feuds and unearthing family secrets. Hello, Beautiful by Anne Napolitano. The sumptuous family saga by the author of Dear Edward is one of those rare novels whose singular characters, mainly four Italian-American sisters and the outsider they embrace as one of their own, are so beautifully rendered it's as if they're your best friends and you're grateful to be in their orbit. Napolitano's homage to Little Women, albeit set in late 20th century Chicago, will prompt you to slow down as you read, never wanting the book to end. When it does, prepare for tears. I Have Some Questions for You by Rebecca Mackay. When 40-year-old film professor and podcaster Bodhi returns to her elite East Coast boarding school to teach, she unearths a hearseload of secrets as she investigates the murder of her former roommate and a miscarriage of justice. In this addictive page-turner, Mackay skewers how and why missing girls become media commodities, particularly if they're young enough and white enough and pretty enough and rich enough that people pay attention. Burnham Wood by Eleanor Catton. Set mostly in a picture postcard New Zealand town, Burnham Wood moves fluently, pitting a guerrilla environmental organization against an American billionaire with more than money on his mind. A deadly landslide, illegal gardens, cocktail parties of the rich and powerful, toil and trouble bubble as Catton skewers the moors of our era in gorgeous language, cementing her reputation as a generational talent. Big Swiss by Jen Began. A creepy sex therapist, a beautiful, unfulfilled wife, an unmoored, middle-aged woman hired to transcribe their taped sessions. What could possibly go wrong? Set in Bohemian Hudson, New York, a college town without a college or a summer camp for adults, Began's black comedy beguiles with its formal frolics and social satire, a laugh-out-loud bad romance for Gen Xers and an ode to misfits who just want to belong. On the Savage Side by Tiffany McDaniel. In this atmospheric Appalachian Gothic, a poet and novelist draws on a string of actual unsolved murders in her native Ohio to capture what goes horribly wrong when women don't fit a customary victim profile. As twin sisters try to avoid a killer lurking amid the shadows, McDaniel artfully evokes each facet of their common humanity, the sinuous landscape, and defiant community in the face of evil. Our Share of Night by Mariana Enriquez. Renowned for her edgy fiction, the Argentine master toggles across decades, tracing the arcs of a father and son cursed with a secret society's clairvoyance and erotic impulses. The stirring, speculative epic, brilliantly translated by Megan McDowell, blends the sweep and politics of Namwali Sirpel's The Old Drift with the dystopian dread of Cormac McCarthy's The Road. Take What You Need by Aydra Novi. In her sublime new novel, Novi alternates between stepmother Jean and estranged daughter Leah, unfurling a family history as layered as the Allegheny Mountain where the book is set. Passion for scrap metal art and an injury leads to an unlikely friendship between Jean and a young neighbor. Upon her mother's accidental death, Leah is compelled to confront a past she attempted to erase. The Urgent Life by Bazoma St. John. Marketing maven St. John has experienced tragedies and triumph. From the death by suicide of her college boyfriend to her husband's terminal cancer, St. John gathers the strength to continue life with their daughter. As she describes her journey through repeated griefs as well as her successes, she inspires us all not to give up despite the obstacles. Liliana's Invincible Summer by Cristina Rivera Garza. The Mexican virtuoso's searing, propulsive memoir probes the murder of her younger sister in 1990, wellspring of her own literary inspiration. Rivera Garza recreates Liliana's death at the hands of a violent ex-boyfriend, opening a Pandora's box of bureaucratic demons and igniting a cold case that rallied a nation to the cause of domestic abuse. Lone Women by Victor Laval. The author of The Changeling, soon to be an Apple TV Plus series, transforms genre in an arresting blend of history, horror, and suspense, showcasing a Black woman's odyssey through the American West at the beginning of the 20th century. There are two kinds of people in this world, those who live with shame and those who die from it. On Tuesday, Adelaide Henry would have called herself the former. By Wednesday, she's on the run to Montana, trying to bury her past just so she can live. Old Babes in the Wood by Margaret Atwood. The news from Gilead may be bleak, but the author of The Handmaid's Tale pushes back with trademark humor and command of craft. A George Saunders-like reimagining of a European folktale, an interview between Margaret Atwood and George Orwell conducted through a seance, a Tennyson-esque lament for a dead pet. These are among the collection's many pleasures. Our next article by Farah Jasmine Griffin is titled Rhyme and Reason. A new biography of poet Phyllis Wheatley explores the life of the first African and third woman in the American colonies to publish a book of poems, and what her voice might mean to us now. Phyllis Wheatley, the enslaved prodigy poet, has fascinated readers since the 18th century, even before the 1773 publication of her volume, Poems on Various Subjects, Religious and Moral. David Waldstreicher's expansive new biography, The Odyssey of Phyllis Wheatley, A Poet's Journeys Through American Slavery and Independence, is sure to inspire new generations with the story of the genius child brought to America on the slave ship Phyllis, for which she was named by her mistress, Susanna Wheatley, who soon discovered and helped to nurture her intellectual and literary gifts. Hailed as a marvel, a miracle even, taught to read English by Susanna and her daughter, she soon penned odes and elegies to and for the elite generation that led America to revolution. They responded in turn. George Washington corresponded with her, Benjamin Franklin visited her in London, and Thomas Jefferson wrote a disparaging white supremacist assessment of her literary capacity. Her name has graced schools and other organizations and institutions in Black communities nationwide. In the centuries following her death, she has been celebrated for her talent, reviled for her seeming capitulation to notions of Africa as unenlightened and pagan, and rescued and reclaimed, especially by Black women writers. Most recently, in The Age of Phyllis, 2020, the poet and novelist Honoré Fanon Jeffers provides a beautiful and provocative meditation on an imagining of Wheatley's origins and interior selves. Waldstreicher joins these efforts in giving us a Wheatley who is most significant for our time as the nation once again engages in the process of redefining itself and its relationship to core principles and values. The Odyssey of Phyllis Wheatley is a rich and necessary book that chronicles her remarkable life as a series of journeys from Africa to America, from Boston to London and back, from the American colonies to the new nation, from American slavery to an aspiration toward freedom. While there is much we will never know about the young girl who would become the first African and the third woman in the colonies to publish a book of poems, Waldstreicher's detailed research into the history and context that produced her raises a number of important questions and reveals possibilities for our consideration. Might the precocious African child have been Muslim and therefore literate prior to her arrival in Boston? Might the markings she wrote on the walls of her master's home have been Arabic script, or were they only the scribblings common of children her age? We are invited to imagine her life before the Wheatleys trained her to be the pious Christian, before they honed her gifts to express gratitude for her enslavement, before her introduction to Christianity and salvation. Such questions underscore that she and the multitude of Africans like her were not blank slates when they arrived on the shores of what would become the United States of America. These multitudes are another gift of Waldstreicher's book. While we have come to think of Wheatley as a singular soul, a black child in a white household, an enslaved child in a city that gave us many of our ideas about freedom, Waldstreicher introduces us to a bevy of named and anonymous, free and enslaved black people in the city of Boston. Among the most fascinating is the well-educated but enslaved Andrew Wendell, praised by his owner for his character for truth, his integrity, who also wrote poetry. In contrast, there was a group described by John Adams as a motley rabble of saucy boys, Negroes, and mulattoes, who affiliated themselves with Irish Teagues and other white ruffians. Most importantly, there was Wheatley's lifelong friend and correspondent, Abor Tanner of Newport, Rhode Island, who might have first met her on board the Phyllis, and John Peters, the free black man whom she would eventually marry. All of this is to say that while Wheatley was no doubt a special and somewhat elite figure, she was neither singular nor alone. Finally, the Wheatley of these pages is an ambitious young woman, certain of her gifts and of her status as a child of God, desirous of freedom for herself and for her fellow blacks, confident that she has something to offer as the nation emerges, and actively engaged in trying to shape her own future and that of the nation she would claim as her own. Hers was a short but remarkable life, one that is especially inspiring in our times because of her fervent belief that her voice mattered, that she should be heard, and that she could shape public opinion on concerns of race, freedom, and democracy. Our next article by Lee Newman is titled, 23 Questions Every Woman Should Ask Herself in 2023. Here's what these crucial questions have in common. Asking them changes everything. In the pages that follow, we explore the ways in which grappling with life's big and little questions can push you toward new possibilities, reveal your deepest truths, and put you on the path to your right life, which, as you'll discover, is yours for the asking. Number 1. Who do I yell at in the quiet in my head? Ah, inner rage. It feels cathartic for a little while, especially when you're making complex but incredibly insightful points with lots of subpoints and bullets and footnotes. But after a while, the process blackens the mind. What would happen if you dealt with your anger beyond the silent borders of your brain? This doesn't necessarily require a confrontation with the object of your fury. It means figuring out why you're so angry with them and why you feel you can't bring it up. Note, this directive applies even if the person you're yelling at is yourself. Number 2, what is the big risk and what is the tiny risk? So you want to start your own company. The big risk is what happens if you lose everything. That risk will appear as a woman in hot pants screaming through your brain with her hair on fire, distracting you from the tiny risk you haven't thought of. For example, what if you do make enough money, but have to work 22 hours a day and never go out on a date until you retire at 83? Number 3, what's the one thing nobody knows about me? Which should probably be followed by, why does nobody know? Number 4, do I have one tiny, easy, uplifting thing that doesn't involve consumption? Something along the lines of singing the entire Top 40 from 1993 in the car as you drive on a highway, or playing pinball in a dumpy bar, or feeding the fat but still hungry-looking squirrels in your yard each morning. Number 6, what would I write on my own fortune cookie? No more strapless gold jumpsuits, joy is a cheese stick, or praying silently is actually a gratitude journal that does not require writing or paper or moving when you are very, very tired. Number 7, how often does my body scream, you're a crazy lady? Headaches, backaches, stomach aches, yeast infections, pimples. These are all code for, I'm tired, stop beating me up, get some sleep and unplug from work. Otherwise, your body might decide that if you're not going to listen, you're soon not going to be able to move. Number 8, what's my go-to spiritual practice? This is a trick question. By asking it, what you're really saying is, I need one, now. For the night you hit a pothole and blow your tire, And also for the moment when you witness a sunset, the miraculous, oft-forgotten color of orange sherbet. Maybe your practice is a long ramble before bed. Maybe a 10-minute meditation in your husband's closet where nobody, not even the toddler, can find you. Maybe it's going to church. Maybe it's an idea you repeat to yourself, like this one from Eckhart Tolle. Stress is wanting something to be the way that it isn't. Because if you give up wanting a blown tire to reassemble before your eyes, you accept the tire is gone and look for a spare. That is the thing about spiritual practices. Yes, they're about your spirit, but your spirit includes your mind, your mouth, and your ability to focus sufficiently on how to operate a jack. Number 9, should I buy a sixth button-up? I love a button-up. They make me feel businessy even when I'm sitting at home typing in bed. At any one time, I have at least 5, which I wear in rotation. My kids think I'm boring, but I take faith in Adam Glassman's assessment. When you look back at your old photos, he says, you're going to want to see yourself happy and radiant. So whatever clothes you wear should make you feel that way. Beautiful, individual, and comfortable in your skin. If that's how you feel, that's how you'll look. So yes, time to purchase yet another radiance-inducing Oxford shirt. Number 10. What would my mother say if she were here? For instance, this applies to when you say yes to the cigarette, it's just one, I'm tipsy, or to the date with Mr. Married with Kids, he's so lonely and sexy and almost separated. The one thing about your mother, father, Grandpa Joe, or whoever it was that raised you is that they all know how to say no to the things that will end up hurting you. Furthermore, they know you. They'll be the first person to encourage you to say yes to those things that bring you significant happiness, like oatmeal for breakfast, even when you don't have time. Number 11, what if I realize that I am always going to be bad at, and yet still continue to do? For me, the answer is bluegrass guitar. Dogs may yowl along, children run screaming from the house, but I will play on, joyously undeterred. Number 12, how much real work have I done towards attaining happiness? We all want to think that if we take our vitamins, write in our journals, and smell a few tulips, we'll be happier. These things help. They do. I'm a fan. And yet, lasting happiness usually requires more. Giving up lunch with your friends to go to a therapist, or not watching TV with your husband at night, and instead talking about whether you should move, or ruthlessly looking for a job that you love instead of one you simply don't loathe. It's discouraging, exhausting work at times, but it is part-time work. You slog along, you feel better. Unhappiness, on the other hand, is 24/7. You don't get to do it for an hour a day and knock off. It's there morning, afternoon, and night. It feels like you can't even quit, but you can. It just takes work. Number 13, what 3 items do I need to keep in my fridge to feel rich? Here's my list. A bottle of champagne, in case of celebrations, a canister of Nestle Quick, in case of low blood sugar, and a bowl of lemons, in case of everything ever, lemon water, lemon on veggies, lemon as marinade, lemons as centerpiece. Just looking at these items makes me feel rich, and by rich I mean that feeling of being safe and lucky and cared for by myself. Number 14. Have I found a graceful way to deal with the stumbles of others? It can be hard, read maddening, to listen to a third grader smugly inform you that the world was formed by 2 meteors crashing together. Then again, it can be hard, read maddening, when your mother pronounces walk as woke, the W cousin of yoke. Have you found a graceful way to correct them? By graceful, I mean kind. But this is necessary only if you're worried the person will stagger around the world with the misinformation glinting like spinach between the teeth. The highest level of grace is going without the correction, letting the minor glaring error flow over you and out of you. You know what the third grader means after all. 2 asteroids, 1 big bang, the world began, how amazing. Number 15, what would happen if I wrote down the story of the person who harmed me? In other words, what do you know about this person, wrote the very wise man who invented the question above. If you do not know them, what can you find out about them? What do you have in common? Even if you were to find only one way in which the two of you are similar, Even if you were to waste an afternoon writing down this meager biography, might it take you just a smidge closer to finding the humanity in that person? Perhaps that is why Desmond Tutu wrote this question in the Book of Forgiving. Number 16. What would happen if I wrote down the story of the person who loved me? Because sometimes we focus only on the painful people, at the expense of those who have sent us Instacart care packages when we had food poisoning, or those who bought us a puppy because we wanted one but just couldn't pull the trigger. Yes, this really happened. Thanks, Dad. Number 17. Do I have a zombie bag, and what's in it? It's likely that you're worried more about a hurricane or a flood than you are zombies. The sort of crisis you might fear, however, is not important for this discussion. So many of us worry that we don't know ourselves well enough. A zombie bag will not completely solve this existential debate, but it will help. We are who we most are in times of crisis. For example, I live near a river. I have one thing in my zombie bag. It is a raft, which I will inflate and load with my children and pets in order to paddle us all to safety, if, say, the city should shut down due to a rogue virus. As COVID-19 turned out, I did not have to use my raft. I was able to drive us all on a normal road in a normal car, but having the raft in my closet still enables me to sleep peacefully at night. It's a mantra. There is a way out. There is always a way out. Number 18, is my dream of retirement possible without moving to another country? Taking a bus costs 10 cents in Nicaragua. Working out at a gym, $16 a month. But I ask yourself, do I really want to live thousands of miles from my family and friends? The time to figure out if you need to save more or take Spanish lessons is now. Number 19, did I take on blank just to not disappoint blank? Fill in the blanks with graduate school, the hospital gala committee, the carpool, the renovation of the house, or mom, dad, my husband, my boss. Amy Spencer, author of Bright Side Up, 100 Ways to Be Happier Right Now, claims that something you do to gain the acceptance of others is really just a smokescreen for something you don't actually want to do at all. Number 20, what one rule works for me? Even if it doesn't work for anyone else, mine is no pizza, ever. I want to be included in the happy excitement of sharing a pizza with my coworkers or friends and kids, but I really only love the cheese and the crust makes me sleepy. Number 21, do I let myself feel the pleasure of stealing? In The Moon Before Morning, W.S. Merwin writes of watching the flowers open at dawn like pink coral in midair, and then sitting at the table reading, which makes him feel as if he's stealing this moment from something else that he should be doing. We all feel this, don't we? We take a weekend morning to daydream or to listen to a piece of music, and then worry that we should be buying groceries or figuring out that weird sound coming from the washing machine. But to Merwin, the pleasure of stealing is part of it. In other words, the stealing is a joyful act. Because, ladies and gentlemen, it's time we are stealing. Not eyeliners, money, or candy. We ought to let ourselves feel that gigglish feeling of taking something without asking, even if what we're taking is time and whom we're taking it from is ourselves. Number 22, do I care too much about what people think? Well, what's too much? Here's why I hesitate. If I answer no, I don't care what people think, I risk seeming arrogant. But if I answer yes, I care too much about what people think, I risk seeming spineless. Such a statement suggests that I've given away my power without even bruising my knuckles. Never mind that we all, to some degree, worry about what people think because we're, you know, human. I don't care whether you're a shock jock or the president of the tacky Christmas sweater club. There's always going to be someone whose love, attention, and respect you're courting. So I'll just give you the honest answer. Yes, I have often cared too much. I grew up in a preppy enclave of Delaware where I was the short, wisecracking girl who was neither popular nor unpopular, who pretended to be dumber and richer than she was, who believed that one day, if she kept adopting the customs and attire of the lockjawed tribe she lived among, she would be seen as normal and everyone would like her. And then she'd marry David Bowie and ride unicorns bareback in a cloud palace. I wish I could say that caring too much about others' opinions vanished as soon as I grew up, but long after I had left the Deb balls and lacrosse fields of my youth, those anxieties still gnawed at me. Instead of writing about what I knew, I spent my 20s imitating others, drunks, junkies, French philosophers, and shying away from what obsessed me, which was the inner lives of women. I thought writing about those things would brand me as either a frivolous lightweight or one more hysterical female. Then I turned 30. I had a baby girl, and my father, after a 16-year battle with cancer, died at 56. He was someone who lived big, and the last time I saw him, when I told him that I was anxious about this motherhood business, anxious that no one would ever want to publish my work, he replied, "You just have to get out of your own way." I had to stop wasting time. Life is brief, but if you're brave, it's deep. That mask I'd been wearing, I had to take it off. I didn't want my daughter to see it in my closet and think it was part of every woman's wardrobe. By investing others with the power to dictate who you are, you rob yourself of an opportunity to truly grow. You shortchange yourself by devaluing the experiences and knowledge you've banked, all those things that have been making you you. And in the end, who cares about being anything else? Number 23, who is the best hugger in my life? Yes, it counts if that hugger is a dog, or the child who is not related to you. Go over and get a hug, even on a good day, especially on a good day, when you think you shouldn't need anything, that everything is fine. You still need a hug, period. All those things that have been making you you, and in the end, who cares about being anything else? Number 23, who is the best hugger in my life? Yes, it counts if that hugger is a dog, or the child who is not related to you. Go over and get a hug, even on a good day, especially on a good day, when you think you shouldn't need anything, that everything is fine. You still need a hug, period. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.